In 195 AD, a leader of the church at Ephesus wrote a heartfelt yet stern letter to the Bishop of Rome. And this letter was in response to that bishop's insistence that this church leader and the congregations for which he spoke in Asia Minor would fall in line with the dictates and the doctrines and traditions of the Latin church and its bishops. And in the final line of that letter, after having clearly laid out his reasons for not following the dictates of the Latin bishops, he provided, I think, was, in my mind, one of the most succinct summaries of why they were choosing not to fall in line. And quoting from Acts 5:29, we read that response that was given. He quoted a verse that was given by Peter and the apostles about 120 years prior, in answer to the religious leaders of their day who were telling them that they should cease from preaching the gospel. And that response, his response, we ought to serve God rather than man. We ought to serve God rather than man. You know, if there's any phrase, I think, that expresses the conviction that's driven so many of God's faithful throughout history, this certainly has to be among them. There's so much in this statement, I think, that drives the reason that you and I meet here today, the reason we do what we do. We observe the traditions, the laws of God, and the way we believe it's true to the way that they were kept by Jesus Christ and the apostles and were intended to be kept. And you and I are only the recent in a long line of faithful who've been, you know, who've bucked the religious tides of their time, the cultural pressures, the expectations to go along with the, you know, preeminent traditions of the day, to walk a walk that we're convicted to walk. And so their words are really our words. Their words are really our legacy. We ought to serve God rather than man. Jesus said in Matthew 6:18, I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. But through preaching of the gospel, we know could not be prevailed against. The gates of hell would not prevail against that message. The gospel in those early years of the church, after that initial flurry of growth, they were in a large measure suppressed. And this letter that I discussed with you from a man named Polycrates, and we'll get to him and who he was and how he played into our early church history and as we go through this message. This letter from Polycrates to this Bishop of Rome was really the climax in a long chain of events that marked the beginning of a long struggle of a small flock to remain faithful to the faith once delivered. You know, we often focus our attention, we talk about our church history, the small groups that we can trace through history that seem to be faithful to the doctrines that we're convicted of, and as well we should. But I want to talk today, take a journey back to where this struggle just began, first began, before the faithful were forced to flee from those who felt that, you know, to not get in line with the doctrinal edicts of a group of men sitting in a large cultural center of that day, to not get in line with those men was evidence that they were heretics and was reason enough to persecute. It's a story I'm sure many of you are familiar with. You know, we've studied and we'd understand the history of our faith, but I think it bears going through again. And we're going to obviously only take a high level as much as you can do in a sermon. But I think it's important for us to review it time to time, not only because to understand their struggles, but also because there might come a time in a not too distant future when you and I are called on to take a stand the way that they took a stand. And I think it really is interesting to go back and see how they responded and to ask ourselves, would that be my response as well? And we might one day be forced to declare we ought to obey God rather than man. So let's go back and dive into a little history, at least, as I said, as little as we can here. What I want to share with you is really a tale of two diametrically different churches, a group of churches that evolved during the early first century, just after the last apostles had passed. One of those groups remained faithful, and one did not. And these two church groups began to emerge as a result of some specific events that occurred shortly after Christ was resurrected and his church began to be built. And how God shepherded his church through this time and the faithful with it, fulfilling his promise of protection that he would build his church and the gates of hell would not prevail against it. Now, I'm going to have a lot of quotes during this thing. That's partly why I'm doing a PowerPoint, and I apologize for some of the reading and the long quotes. But I feel like it's important to show some of these quotes because they're actual evidence of history rather than some guy just standing up and telling you what happened. That would be even more boring than reading long quotes, I trust you. So for those who wish to take notes, good luck. Not going to be easy, but I will have the PowerPoint available to anybody who wants it. And if it's possible to put it on the website, if anybody would like it, I'll see if it can be posted out there. So let's begin. Here we have a map of the early first century churches circa 70-80 AD. Prior to 70 AD, the headquarters of the church as a whole was considered to be Jerusalem, and all the churches that had been established by the apostles since Jesus' death looked to that church, to its leaders, for guidance and direction. But just leading up to and culminating in 70 AD, that all began to change. Some events began to happen that began to result in this area, Jerusalem, losing its influence in the church at large. So let's retrace what happened. Around 66 AD, the Roman procurator or administrator, Gessius Florus, he was a man, history reveals, who had no love for the Jews, in order to bolster sagging tax revenues, seized silver from the temple. And to squash the understandable uproar at this action, he sent troops into Jerusalem who ended up massacring about 3,600 citizens. And that was a spark that ignited an explosive rebellion known as the First Jewish Revolt that had been sizzling for quite some time. And this was kind of just the catalyst that sparked it. This revolt against Roman domination, occurring between 66 and 70 AD, was brutally put down by the Roman Emperor Titus. In 70 AD, he and his armies began a siege of the city and those rebels inside of it, and it brought the whole city and everybody inside its walls to its knees. If you ever read history of that time, it's brutal the way that the Romans treated the inhabitants of the city at that time. It was the worst possible time as well for such a siege to happen, just before Passover, when many pilgrims who had journeyed from to Jerusalem to observe the feast were within the city walls. So the walls were filled to capacity pretty much. The historian Josephus claims that around 1.1 million people perished in that, or were killed by the Romans. During that siege, and in the ensuing sack of the city, a fire was started by the Roman soldiers, it's believed, by order of Titus himself, the Roman emperor, that consumed the temple area. The Romans originally had intended to preserve the temple, but Titus was so incensed at the Jewish rebels' unwillingness to surrender that he ordered it to be set on fire. It's disputed that it was him, but most historians concur that they believe it was him who ordered the fire set. A couple of interesting anecdotes around this. The temple was destroyed on the 10th of AV, or Av, the same day the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 587 AD, or BC. It's the fifth month in the Jewish calendar. It corresponds to our July and August. And coincidentally, it's interesting to speculate, and it's all really all it is, was that, God possibly trying to send a message, allowing the temple to, on both occasions, on the same date of the Jewish calendar, to be burned with fire. Why would that be significant? Well, we know that God tells us he purifies with fire. Fire is a symbol of purification. Zechariah 13:9 says, putting people through the fire, purifying like silver and testing them like gold. That's how he refines us. Deuteronomy 4:24 tells us the Lord your God is a consuming fire. Ezekiel 23:38 says God condemns his people for defiling the temple, or his temple. So it's could it be possible he was purifying the temple by fire, in a sense, during these two events. Speculation, but it's interesting speculation. Another interesting anecdote around the destruction of the temple in 70 AD relates to a prophecy that we're familiar with that Jesus gave in Matthew 24. He prophesied that, he said, well, we'll read it here, then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. And so again, we know that prophecy is often dual, and I think Mr. Shaw made a very good point a few weeks ago in his sermon that during this event in 70 AD, the prophecy wasn't completely fulfilled because there were actually stones that were left on top of one another. But it could be, again, a type of that ultimate fulfillment that will potentially one day happen. But why did they so completely disassemble and destroy the temple in 70 AD? What was the reason? Well, again, speculation that because the temple was set on fire, much of the gold in the temple that the temple walls were adorned with and various aspects of the temple would have melted and ran down beneath the stones and between the stones in order for the Romans to get at that gold, those riches, prying those stones up would have been necessary to get at some of the gold that they wanted to haul with them back to Rome. Again, speculation, but it seems plausible. Much of the gold that was brought back to Rome was melted into Roman coins and bore the words Judeo Capta, meaning Judea defeated, and a reminder of Titus's victory. The sacred vessels that were not destroyed in the fire, including the table on which the bread of God's presence had been put, the menorah, the curtain, and all the other objects that nobody except the high priest was allowed to see, were carried through Rome in a celebration victory on their return. There's an arch that stands in Rome today near the Roman Colosseum that was built by the Emperor Domitian, Titus's older brother, in 81 AD, and to honor his brother's victory over the Jews. And if you look closely at the inscription or the artwork and the arch of that tunnel or temple, the arch of the arch, you'll see this artwork depicting the menorah and other items being brought back from the temple and its destruction. Interestingly enough, the Colosseum itself was built by some 97,000 Jewish prisoners who were carried back from Rome or from Jerusalem into Rome. Quite a sight to see if you've been able to visit there. I, like many of you who have visited Rome, maybe have been to this place, and you can't help but be floored by the opulence of the Vatican and St. Peter's Basilica. I couldn't help but wonder if, obviously this has been torn down and rebuilt over time, but you wonder, is there any of the temple gold somehow adorning the walls of this place? Can't help but speculate. Again, speculation, but it would be certainly ironic, wouldn't it, if that were the case? Okay, enough speculation, and back to some of those long historical quotes I mentioned. So what happened to the Christians in Jerusalem around the time of the terrible siege? Well, we have this from the Jewish historian Josephus, writing around 75 AD. Josephus, as we know, is a Jewish historian, and he writes this, besides these signs, a few days after that feast on the 1 and 20th day of the month of Artemisius, a certain prodigious and incredible phenomenon appeared. I suppose the account of it would seem to be a fable were it not related to those who saw it, by those who saw it, and were not the events that followed it of so considerable a nature as to deserve such signals. For before sunsetting, chariots and troops of soldiers in their armor were seen running among the clouds and surrounding of cities. Moreover, at that feast, which we call Pentecost, as the priests were going by night into the inner court of the temple, as their custom was to perform their sacred ministrations, they said that in the first place they felt a quaking and heard a great noise, and after that they heard a sound of a great multitude saying, let us remove hence. So kind of a difficult read there, but basically what it's saying is it was believed that, you know, Christians in Jerusalem were miraculously warned in advance of the siege that was going to occur, that they should flee. And, you know, it's been disputed whether this is actually true or not, although we have some precedents. You know, Joseph and his wife were warned in advance to flee, so it's not without precedence that that could happen. But there was a fleeing out of the city prior to the siege of Jerusalem by a group of Christians. You know, prior to this time, Jews and Christians had worshipped together. But needless to say, the Christians' refusal to support and participate in the uprising was not greeted kindly by their Jewish brothers. In addition to that, the new intolerance that was taking hold during the revolt toward unorthodox Jewish practices, as well as the increasing rejection of parts of the Mosaic law by Christians, this all kind of culminated in the Christians in Jerusalem being banished from the synagogues. Despite that, after the siege had ended, there were groups of Christians that did seek to return to Jerusalem. But something was different about this group of Christians. Something was different. Notice what historian E. Gibbon in his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire states. Again, they fled to Pella. He says, the Nazarenes retired from the ruins of Jerusalem to the little town of Pella beyond the Jordan, where that ancient church languished above 60 years in solitude and obscurity. They still enjoyed the comfort of making frequent and devout visits to the holy city and the hope of being one day restored to those seats which both nature and religion taught them to love as well as to revere. But at length, under the reign of Hadrian, the desperate fanaticism of the Jews filled up the measure of their calamities, and the Romans, exasperated by their repeated rebellions, exercised the rites of victory with unusual rigor. The emperor founded, under the name of Alia Capitolina, a new city on Mount Zion, to which he gave the privileges of a colony, and denouncing the severest penalties against any of the Jewish people who should dare to approach its precincts, he fixed a vigilant garrison of a Roman cohort to enforce the execution of his orders. The Nazarenes had only one way left to escape the common proscription, and the force of truth was on this occasion assisted by the influence of temporal advantages. They elected Marcus to be their bishop, a prelate of the race of the Gentiles, and most probably a native either of Italy or of some of the Latin provinces. At his persuasion, the most considerable part of the congregation renounced the Mosaic law in the practice of which they had persevered above a century. And by this sacrifice of their habits and prejudices, they purchased a free admission into the colony of Hadrian. When the name and honors of the Church of Jerusalem had been restored to Mount Zion, the crimes of heresy and schism were imputed to the obscure remnant of the Nazarenes, which refused to accompany their Latin bishop. They still preserved their former habitation of Pella, spread themselves into the villages adjacent to Damascus, and formed an inconsiderable church in the city of Bersea, or as it is now called, of Aleppo in Syria. So these Christians, known as Nazarenes, returned to Jerusalem around 130 AD. The way that they avoided Roman penalty was by renouncing the Mosaic law and appointing a Gentile bishop, or believed to be from Italy, to preside over them. And only then could they gain access to this new colony that Hadrian had built. It's interesting that it was a Latin bishop. It says something, I think, about the sentiment in Rome against Jewish tradition. Even though peace was largely restored, small clashes continued to occur between Jews and Romans in the area after 70 AD, but in 132 that again came to boil to a head. Because of Hadrian's attempt to wipe out Judaism from the city, first by founding this Roman colony, and then by placing strict restrictions on the Jewish religion, religious freedoms and practices, there's a full-scale revolt that occurred in 135. But this time, it was put down violently, and all the Jews were ordered to be expelled from Jerusalem completely. So the Christian church that remained at Jerusalem, such as it was, now became made up entirely of Gentiles. So here in Jerusalem, the church that once served as headquarters of the early church Christians became separated from their Jewish roots and traditions. And you can imagine the events in Jerusalem had large repercussions throughout the Christian, for all Christians throughout the empire. In his book, Sabbath and Sunday in Early Christianity, Robert Leo Odum writes, "The second century opened with intense antipathy manifested throughout the Roman Empire by pagan Gentiles toward Jews as a result of Jewish uprisings against the Roman government in Palestine, Egypt, Cyprus, and Cyrene during the reign of Trajan, 98 to 117. It reached its climax during the Jewish revolt led by Bar Kokhba in Judea during the 132 to 135 revolt. Emperor Hadrian crushed the long and bloody revolt with terrible severity, razed Jerusalem, and established a heathen community there and made it a capital crime for a Jew to set foot on soil." So Judaism was outlawed by harsh decrees of the emperor, and all of its religious practices, especially Sabbath observance, Passover celebration, and circumcision, were prohibited under penalty of death. Although the Hadrianic decrees were softened somewhat by Antoninus Pius in 138 to 161, widespread animosity toward Judaism and everything that seemed to smack of it smoldered for long afterward. And so the stakes were obviously pretty high for early Christians who believed the Sabbath and the other traditions that they observed were still valid, that should be kept. Unless you were willing to face the wrath of the Roman government, there was every motivation to avoid any semblance of Jews, the Jews and their religion. So there was a separation then between the Christian faith gradually that began to take place that was catalyzed by these events from the Christian larger Christian community. Okay, so like I said, a lot of quotes, a lot of history, and my background's in training, so I'm told that in order to make sure people are engaged, you have to occasionally redirect and do something completely different. And so I thought I'd throw this up there. Well, good, there were a few laughs. That's good. And then for those of you who jokes don't work, I'm told this is really effective. Some audiences. Okay. So, okay, hopefully. We're all back now? Okay. So those Christians who were convicted that they should not forsake the traditions passed from Christ and the apostles were facing some difficult choices. God didn't let Satan have the complete victory, as we know. He'd promised that the gates of hell would not prevail against the church, and he made sure that it didn't. But how? Well, we have this from the church historian Eusebius, written in the 4th century. "This heresy of the Nazarenes exists in Berea, in the neighborhood of Coel, Syria, and the Decapolis in the region of Pella, and in Bassanitis in the so-called Kokhba, for there it took its beginnings after the exodus from Jerusalem, when all the disciples went to live in Pella because Christ had told them to leave Jerusalem and go away since it would undergo a siege." And so Eusebius, writing a couple of hundred years after the Jewish revolt, about this initial flight to Pella, tells us this group of Christians was still living there, now having been given the name of Nazarene, which by that time had become to be viewed as a sect by what had become the Latin Church in Rome. So it seems some of those who had fled Jerusalem remained in Pella, but not all stayed in Pella. Notice where else they fled. The Roman bishop Jerome, in a letter written to Augustine in AD 404, writes the following: "The matter in debate, therefore, or should I rather say your opinion regarding it, is summed up as this, that since the preaching of the gospel of Christ, the believing Jews do well in observing the precepts of the law, in offering sacrifices as Paul did, in circumcising their children as Paul did in the case of Timothy, and in keeping the Jewish Sabbath as all the Jews have been accustomed to do. If this be true, we fall into the heresy of Cerinthus and Ebion, who though believing in Christ, were anathemized by the Father for this one error, that they mixed up the ceremonies of the law with the gospel of Christ, and professed their faith in that which was new without letting go what was old." Apparently that's a problem. "Why do I speak of the Ebionites who make pretensions to the name of Christian? In our own day, there exists a sect among the Jews throughout all the synagogues of the East which is called the sect of Mene, and is even now condemned by the Pharisees. The adherents of this sect are known commonly as Nazarenes. They believe in Christ, the Son of God, born of the Virgin Mary, and they say that he who suffered under Pontius Pilate and rose again is the same as the one in whom we believe, but they desire to be both Jews and Christians. And so these Sabbath-keeping Nazarenes, it seems, fled to Pella, but also many of them began to make their way up into the synagogues of the East, which is a reference to Asia Minor, the churches of Asia Minor. So after the siege of 70 AD, continuing through 135 AD and after, these Christians continued to dwell in around Pella and worship in the churches that had been established in the communities around Asia Minor. Okay, this is where things, I think, kind of get interesting. I don't believe it was by chance that this is where they fled. It's my sense anyway, whether by choice, though, or whether it was God's guidance. I tend to think it was the latter. They fled to this region, as we'll see, where God's people were more firmly grounded in the truth, in the faith once delivered, than anywhere else in the empire. So here we have the outlines of two churches that were beginning to form. One was the churches that were beginning to form in the West, and here in the East, primarily in the region of Asia Minor. Two groups that were to grow increasingly separate and distinct in terms of tradition and practice. Okay, so now let's discuss another event that occurred in the early church that served, I think, to further divide these two church groups. And this event was hurried along in many ways by what we've just discussed, the separation of the Jewish faith traditions from many of the traditions that began to be adopted by the larger Roman church. And that was the gradual influence and acceptance of false doctrine. You know, from the very beginning, we were warned, the church was warned, and Jesus and the apostles warned the followers about the danger of false teachers who would begin to invade the church. In Matthew 24, he said that many would come in his name, claiming to represent him, saying that I am the Christ or that I represent Christ. In Acts 20, the apostle Paul would write, "For this I know, that after my departure, savage wolves would come in, not sparing the flock." 2 Thessalonians 2, 7 through 15, Paul exhorted the brethren, "For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work, that we are bound to give thanks to God always for you, brethren, beloved by the Lord, because God from the beginning chose you for salvation through sanctification by the Spirit and the belief in the truth." And he says in here in verse 15, "Therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which you were taught." Hold the traditions. Hold the things that were passed down by word or by epistle. 2 Peter 2, 1 through 3, writing around 65 AD, Peter writes, "But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, even denying the Lord who brought them." Okay, so Peter's words written here, coming 32 years after Jesus' ascension to the Father, they weren't so much prophetic as a wake-up call. These things were already beginning to occur. There were already false teachers among them, trying to exploit the brethren, trying to pull them to another gospel. But the full force of that other gospel was just beginning to be felt. And there were some factors that really contributed to the effectiveness of these false teachers coming into the flock and beginning to have influence. For one, it's important to understand the information in the Roman Empire didn't travel like it does today. I think that's obvious. Don't have internet. But unless you were along a mail route or you were grouped together, the churches that were more closely grouped together, they could communicate somewhat easier and share information. But the churches that were further away did not have as much contact. In other areas of Roman Alexandria, it was less frequent. Communication was often slower. So that's one aspect. Some churches, because of this, would begin to operate somewhat autonomously in their own area, developing their own traditions, their own particular way of doing things. So that's one possible reason. Secondly, while most congregations were busy laboring in the fields, the poor rural congregations, They're doing the work. They're shepherding the flock. They were suffering through persecutions. Their centers of philosophy in some of these in Rome and places like Alexandria, many in the congregations were much more well off. And leaders of these churches had more time to write, more time to consider new teachings, more time to debate, more time to think about all the ins and outs of doctrine and potentially to engage with some of these false teachers that others in the more rural areas just didn't do. Thirdly, the pressure of the Roman government, I think, is obvious, came to bear against in the larger cities, had more influence over the church and the persecution they felt, as well as influence over the activities of the church as we know. Fourth, as we discussed, there was the estrangement of Christians in these larger metropolitan cities from their Jewish roots. They began to be separated from their Jewish roots and therefore begin to develop their traditions outside of the Jewish traditions. And then finally, in addition to the larger, these larger metropolitan churches, if you will, experience rapid influx of Gentiles into the church, which in some cases had the effect of overwhelming the church, the ability to deal with all the traditions and all the Gentile practices that were coming into them. So there's a lot of factors that came to bear that led to some of these larger cultural centers being more susceptible to the influence of false doctrine. Records in the early church tell us that the Apostle John, who has, as we've seen, he was a strong defender of the faith. He was the longest living of the original disciples of Jesus and the only remaining apostle after A.D. 60 who had oversight. Which churches? Asia Minor. That area that was convicted and strong in the faith once delivered. He had oversight over that area of the church since about A.D. 40. And John was no stranger to doing battle to false teachings. Won't take time to read the whole thing, but he writes in 2 John 1, verse 4, I rejoice greatly that I have found some of your children walking in truth as we received commandment from the Father. So I plead with you, lady, not as though I wrote a new commandment to you, but that which we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. And then I'll go ahead and read the whole. This is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment that as you have heard from the beginning, you should walk in it. For many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess Jesus Christ is coming in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. Look to yourselves that we do not lose those things that we worked for, but that we may receive our full reward. So I'm not going to get into the details of the heresies that were running rampant in the Roman Empire at that time. Leave that for another day. But just want to focus on John's admonition here. To, as you have heard from the beginning, walk in it. Do not lose the things we worked for. And this was really John's focus. This is really John's strength among the many strengths that obviously the apostles had. He was a strict proponent of the traditions once delivered. And so it's obvious probably as the last remaining apostle, he would feel the weight of responsibility to defend the church against those who would pollute and distort the gospel. And he dearly wanted to impress upon the church, those that he was teaching, that they should remain faithful to those traditions. In a time not too distant from Paul's ministry, a great false church would, as we know, would begin to label people who stuck to those traditions that John espoused and others who followed him as heretics. And many would ultimately pay the ultimate price for their life, for refusing to capitulate to the teachings of that false church. But at least initially after the fall of Jerusalem, and to much of that first and second centuries, much of the Christian world seems to have turned to Asia Minor. Asia Minor, because John was the last living apostle, was looked at as defenders of the faith. And they actually they wanted their help in battling some of these heretics and false teachers that were coming into the church. So initially there was more of a relationship of assistance that was going on, and John and some of his followers, one in particular we'll talk about, was stepped in to really help against those false teachers and to battle those teachings. It's believed that the Apostle John died somewhere between 99 to 110 A.D., and he left a successor, a man who'd been closely mentored by him to fight the battle, and fight it he did. His name was Polycarp. And this is a depiction. It was really difficult to find a depiction of him that hadn't been glamorized by the Rome, by the church with all of the regalia and the halos around his head. Because at this time, he was a man who was venerated by the Catholic Church for what he did to try to fight a lot of the doctrines that later became actually accepted within the Roman Church. And you know, the question you sometimes ask at parties, who would you most like to meet? This is one of those guys I can't wait to meet. Interesting character, Polycarp. Irenaeus, who was a Greek cleric writing in 180 A.D. He was a fierce proponent of heresy, and he came from the same region that Polycarp did, up in Smyrna in Asia Minor. He records this about Polycarp. But Polycarp also was not only instructed by apostles and conversed with many who had seen Christ, but was also by apostles in Asia appointed bishop of the church in Smyrna, always taught the things which he had learned from the apostles, and which the church had handed down, and which alone are true. To these things all the Asiatic churches testify, and do also those men who have succeeded Polycarp down to the present time. And so we have from this early Roman Catholic source that Polycarp and his successors in Asia Minor, at least to the time that Irenaeus wrote this, around 180 AD, practiced the true teachings that they learned from the apostles. The 17th century historian William Cave reported that early Christians in Asia Minor kept the Sabbath. Notice what he said. He says, the Sabbath or Saturday, for the, so the word Sabbatum is constantly used in the writings of the fathers, when speaking of it as it relates to Christians, was held by them in great veneration, and especially in the eastern parts, honored with all the public solemnities of religion. This is plain not only from some passages in Ignatius and Clement's Constitutions, but from writers of more unquestionable credit and authority. Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria, tells us that they assembled on Saturdays, not that they were infected with Judaism, but only to worship Jesus Christ, the Lord of the Sabbath. Sozomen, a Christian historian writing in the mid-5th century, reported that the people of Constantinople and among and almost everywhere in Asia Minor assembled together on the Sabbath, as well as on the first day of the week, which custom is never observed in Rome or at Alexandria. And so we here see a group of churches in and around Asia Minor, unlike the Gentile church that was now at Jerusalem, unlike the churches of the West, most notably at Rome and Alexandria, are remaining for at least a little while, at least until the mid-second century, connected to their Jewish roots, remaining true to the faith once delivered by Christ and the apostles. The further the churches to the west in places like Rome and Alexandria got away from the faith once delivered, the more susceptible they became to false teaching, and it began to run rampant. Well, I'm not sure why we need that. We'll continue on. These events, as you can imagine, were distressing to the faithful churches of Asia Minor, led by John and then by his successor Polycarp. The churches of the West were still very much viewed as brethren in the faith. Something had to be done in Polycarp in order to battle the heresy, to try to assist the Roman church with the heretics that were seeking influence in that region, took it upon himself to act. And so he traveled no small distance to Rome to assist in confronting the heresy that was becoming more prevalent there. And there were apparently so many heresies beginning to be promulgated in Rome that he felt, as a senior leader of the church, the one most closely connected to the last living apostle, that it was his responsibility. Irenaeus, again a Greek cleric writing in 180 AD, he writes that some of these heretics were having great success spreading their false doctrine in this environment. Valentius, one of these false teachers, came to Rome in the time of Hyginus, bishop of Rome, between AD 136 and 140. flourished under Pius, bishop from 140 to 155, a bishop of the Roman Church, and remained until Anicetus, 155 to 166, another bishop. Certain two, Marcion, both false Gnostic teachers, then succeeding him, flourished under Anicetus. Irenaeus continues, but Polycarp also was not only instructed by apostles and conversed with many who had seen Christ, but was also by apostles in Asia, appointed bishop of the church in Smyrna, always taught the things that which he had learned from the apostles, and which the church had handed down, and which alone are true. To these things all the Asiatic churches testify, as do also those men who have succeeded Polycarp down to the present time, a man who was of much greater weight and more steadfast witness of truth than Valentinus and Marcion and the rest of the heretics. He it was, coming to Rome in the time of Anicetus, caused many to turn away from the aforesaid heretics to the Church of God, proclaiming that he had received this one and sole truth from the apostles, John, the disciple of the Lord, exclaiming, "Let us fly, lest even the bathhouse fall down, because Cerinthus, the enemy of the truth, is within." And Polycarp himself replied to Marcion, who met him on one occasion and said, "Dost thou know me? I do know thee, the firstborn of Satan," was his response. You can think about Polycarp and what he was faced with at this time in a Roman Empire that was still very, very actively persecuting the brethren in both these churches in Rome, Alexandria, and in the larger churches of the Roman Empire. And then your own church begins to pull away and begins to divorce itself from its roots. And you are very much convicted that this is not the direction. Imagine that decision point you have to make as a leader in the church at that time to say, you know, we need to obey God rather than men and put ourselves in those shoes. It's just interesting to note that the church at Rome, they were deferring to Polycarp at this time, and so they were looking to him and his influence to help with this issue of the heresies that were confronting them. A couple things about the heretics that he was coming to confront. Marcion was possibly the first Gnostic heretic to attempt to do away with the Sabbath. Valentius of Rome, who Polycarp denounced in that quote we just read, is believed the first affiliated with Christianity to teach the concept of the Trinity or to make a clear statement of equality regarding the three alleged persons of the Godhead. Considering the Sabbath is no longer observed by this church, the false church and her offshoots, and the Trinity is widely accepted. Ultimately, Polycarp was not very effective, but he put up a battle nonetheless. History also records one other confrontation with heretical teaching that it seems Polycarp was not ultimately successful at putting down, and that has to do with the observance of Easter over in place of Passover. Easter was not observed by the second century Christians in Asia Minor, such as Polycarp. He and the churches that he oversaw instead observed Passover, and as Jesus had, as the disciples had, and as he'd been taught by John. Beginning, though, with possibly the Roman bishop Sixtus, between 115 and 124 AD, what's now called Easter began to be observed, and changing that observance of Passover from the 14th of Nisan to a Sunday. It's recorded that Polycarp discussed, quote-unquote, and this is recorded by the Catholic Church, so you have to read between the lines, and when they say discussed, it probably was more of a heated exchange than they record, that they discussed this issue with Anicetus, the bishop of Rome, sometime in the 150s AD, but to no effect. It seems the heresy had been rooted so long in the tradition of the Roman Empire, the Roman Church, rather, that it could not be stamped out. Irenaeus, the church historian we've already quoted from, he writes about this supposedly congenial encounter, and when the blessed Polycarp was sojourning in Rome in the time of Anicetus, although a slight controversy had arisen among them as to certain other points, for neither could Anicetus persuade Polycarp to forego the observance in his own way, inasmuch as these things had been always observed by John, the disciple of our Lord, and by other apostles with whom he had been conversant. Nor, on the other hand, could Polycarp succeed in persuading Anicetus to keep the observance in his way, for he maintained that he was bound to adhere to the usage of the presbyters who preceded him, and in this state of affairs they held fellowship with each other. And Anicetus conceded to Polycarp and the church the Jerusalem of the Eucharist, or the Passover service, by way of showing him respect, so they parted in peace from one another, maintaining peace with the whole church, both those who did observe this custom and those who did not. It shouldn't be lost, I think, that Irenaeus was, again, he was a writer for the Catholic Church, and so he's putting lipstick on a pig, in a sense, here with this encounter. How do we know? How do we know that's the case? Well, a Catholic monk, apologies, I forgot to advance one there. There we go. Catholic monk Epiphanius, writing of the same encounter in the 4th century, wrote, "For long ago, even from the earliest days, the Passover was celebrated at different times in the church. In the time of Polycarp and Victor, the East was at odds with the West, and they would not accept letters of commendation from each other." So there was a standoff. This was actually a heated exchange, not as rosy as a relationship that was painted in the previous quote. So the issue most certainly was handled diplomatically. There was some pointed conversations. But that pointed if it was polite discourse, that didn't last for long before the gloves came off. As voices of influence in the Roman Church, the Western Church, began to grow in prominence and authority, the Church of the East could no longer resist politely as Polycarp had done. Their resistance became more forceful. That was, I think, some ladies who like hats might enjoy this one in the audience. It was for them. Okay, finally, we come to our first century brother in Christ that I quoted at the outset of this message, a man named Polycrates. And he was the bishop of Ephesus in Asia Minor. He wrote a letter to the Roman bishop Victor in 195 AD, about 40 years after Polycarp's death. And Victor had advocated that all who professed Christ should change Passover once and for all from the 14th of Nisan to Sunday. And it's not clear whether the Sabbath, and other holy days were now not observed in the Western Church at all. This was just the one remaining argument that was left, or that was, somehow all encapsulated in this one argument. But this argument was known, as you may be familiar with, it was called the Quartodeciman controversy. But Polycrates, cementing the stance of the Church of the East, he wrote a letter that I think is very moving, and I think it speaks to you and I today. It speaks to me when I read it, for the stand that he took and the stand that all of God's people through history have to at times take against those who wish to undermine the truth. He writes pointedly, "We observe the exact day, neither adding nor taking away. For in Asia also great lights have fallen asleep, which shall rise again on the day of the Lord's coming, when he shall come with glory from heaven and shall seek out all the saints. Among these are Philip, one of the 12 apostles, who fell asleep at Hierapolis, and his two aged virgin daughters and another daughter who lived in the Holy Spirit and now rests at Ephesus. And moreover, John, who was both a witness and a teacher, who reclined upon the bosom of the Lord, and being a priest, wore the sacerdotal plate. He fell asleep at Ephesus, and Polycarp in Smyrna, who was a bishop and a martyr, and Thrasius, bishop and martyr from Eumenia, who fell asleep in Smyrna. Why need I mention the bishop and martyr Sagaris, who fell asleep in Laodicea, or the blessed Papirius, or Melito, or Eunuch, the eunuch who lived altogether in the Holy Spirit and who lies at Sardis, awaiting the episcopate from heaven when he shall rise from the dead." Obviously a belief in the final resurrection as opposed to an immortal soul. "All these observed the 14th day of the Passover according to the gospel." There we go. "All of these observed the 14th day of the Passover according to the gospel, deviating in no respect but following the rule of faith. And I also, Polycrates, the least of you all, do according to the tradition of my relatives, some of whom I have closely followed. For seven of my relatives were bishops, and I am the eighth, and my relatives always observe the day when the people put away the leaven. I therefore, brethren, who have lived 65 years in the Lord and have met with the brethren throughout the world and have gone through every holy scripture, am not affrighted by terrifying words. For those greater than I have said, we ought to obey God rather than men. We ought to obey God rather than men. You know, clearly Polycrates and the churches of Asia Minor with this statement were sealing their death sentence. If they could have seen just a few decades and centuries into the future. They were rejecting the growing authority of the bishops of Rome and these and other doctrinal matters. And it's telling that Pope Victor attempted to cut Polycrates and others in Asia Minor after this from fellowship within the Roman Church because they took this stance, but later he reversed the decision because of pressure from some of the other leaders in the church who weren't ready to go to that extent. It's also interesting to note that Polycrates died 1 year later, and whereas we have very clear references to martyrs and saints that they've labeled as such for dying, being martyred for the faith, there's nothing written about how he died, which is interesting and peculiar. And the rest of, as they say, is history, and history we know well. The Passover, Easter, Sabbath, Sunday issue was settled in favor of the Roman practice in the Council of Nicaea under the influence of Constantine in 325 AD, kind of the long progression of this this moving away from our roots, our traditions that Christ and the apostles had left us, and along with the blessing and direction of Constantine, the emperor at that time, who gained religion, or some say greater political influence because of his influence over the church, adopting that as his religion. It's said that one of the greatest impacts of Constantine's influence on Christianity was to turn a persecuted religion into a persecuting one. The faithful were gradually persecuted. Over time, it became worse and worse. Forced to flee into the wilderness from persecution by this apostate church, which now wielded the influence and power of the Roman government. Persecution continued against God's people in various forms, sometimes horrifically, until the Protestant Reformation in the 16th and 17th centuries. And today, in our time, you and I, most Christian-professing peoples in the world, with a few exceptions, are able to practice our faith in the relative peace and safety without fear of this type of persecution, and with the exception of the difficulties with work, with family, and what have you that we face because of our convictions around the Sabbath and the holy days and others of our beliefs. We don't face a great deal of hardship, at least not to the level that these did in the preceding centuries. However, you and I know that for those who would be true to the faith once delivered, the peace that we're experiencing now is only the calm before the storm. That the days are coming, and may not be too far ahead, when we will be called on to take a stand. Matthew 5, 10 through 12. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Not that we're glad in the face of persecution, but glad for the hope that is within us and the day that is coming when all those who have died in the faith will raise to meet him in the air. You and I have a legacy of faith that's gone before us. And that's really my goal for sharing this with us today, is we carry on a baton. It didn't just stop with what we read in the scriptures, in the book of Acts, and the letters. There were men and women who went on after that to fight that battle on through history. They fought the good fight and finished the race. So my hope is in not to bore you today, but to share a little history, to encourage you that when we stand for the truth, we carry on that legacy. We carry on the torch for them. And I pray and I'm confident that when we are called upon to confront, to stand up for our faith, we'll do as they did, that we'll answer as they did, confidently, with conviction. We ought to serve God rather than man.